This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
This is Leo Huckvale. I'm here at NAMM 2012 with Dave Jones, who is an ex-Jodcaster.
I am.
So you've got quite an interesting job, I think. Perhaps you could tell us perhaps what you do on a day-to-day basis.
I now work for the European Southern Observatory in Chile, so a completely different kind of observatory to Jodrell Bank, because it's looking in the optical, the kind of light you see with your eyes, rather than the radio like Jodrell. So my job kind of has two completely distinct aspects to it. So the more interesting one, that most people would think was more interesting, is around about a third of my time I work for the Very Large Telescope in Chile. So it's actually eight telescopes, so a very large telescope is not a great name. There are in fact four telescopes, each with an 8-meter mirror, which makes it one of the world's largest, each one of them one of the world's largest. And then four smaller telescopes, which we can combine to make a bigger telescope as part of an interferometer. And so my job entails being there around about a third of the year, performing observations for astronomers that can't come to Chile, because it's much cheaper to pay me to be there than it is to fly everyone there, and making sure that they get the best possible data, and making sure that the telescopes work, making sure that everything runs very smoothly, and that they get the best possible science. And then the other aspect of my work that's maybe less interesting to most people, but more interesting to me, is I get to do my own research. So when I'm not at the telescope, I live in the capital city of Chile, Santiago, and I have an office there where I can do my own research. So the data that I've taken at telescopes like the VLT or at other telescopes, I analyze them and discover new things.
So could you tell us maybe a bit more about the research you do?
Sure. Well, I'm interested in quite a lot of things, but the thing I'm most interested in right now are things called post-common envelope binaries. So these are stars, binary stars, so that's two stars in orbit around each other, which have at some point in their lives undergone what we call a common envelope, which is quite difficult to explain, so I need to go back earlier on into the life of a star to try and explain what it is. So if we think the Sun is kind of on its own, but quite a lot of stars form in pairs, around about 50%, but we don't know exactly how many, then very rarely of exactly the same mass. Sometimes they can be much heavier than one, can be much heavier than the other, but normally one is quite heavier, quite a bit heavier than the other. And that means that it evolves faster. So most stars, like the Sun's about 5 billion years old, and it's been kind of the same for all of those 5 billion years. And for the next 5 billion years, it'll still be pretty much exactly the same. But then right at the end, in a period of only a few million years, compared to the 10 billion that it lives on the main sequence as a normal star, it changes dramatically. And the main thing that happens is the star swells up to about 500 times its size. So that means that if you have two stars that are quite close together, when they're normal stars, when they're on the main sequence, they're close to each other, but not so close. But then when one star evolves and becomes a red giant and swells up, it can engulf the other star. And then the processes that go on within the common envelope, the cloud of gas that's now engulfing the center of the red giant and its binary partner, and how that material gets thrown away and what the star looks like when it comes out of the other end is very interesting.
So these stars, when they reach the end of their lives, they're sort of blowing big cosmic bubbles.
Absolutely. So this is the main reason I ended up interested in this kind of thing, is because I initially worked on these objects called planetary nebulae, which are the things that Hubble takes millions of photographs of and that end up in all of the coffee table astronomy books, the most beautiful images in astronomy, which are the gas that's thrown away from a star, from a normal star, when it dies. Very heavy stars, very massive stars, they explode as supernovae. But the sort of normal stars like the Sun, they form these planetary nebulae. And one of the big burning questions in that field is, how can you take a round star and make a nebula that isn't round, because you see all of these images and they look like hourglasses, or they have big streams of knots and jets flying away from the central star, and we don't understand what forms these. But one of the best explanations we have is that the star that's dying, is not on its own. And if the star is close enough to another star that it will form this common envelope, that it will swallow up its partner, then that's the best way to form these really elongated, the most aspherical shapes.
So what sort of evidence do we have towards these, a sort of link between the shape of these things and the binary stars at their centre?
So the idea that this has been, that binaries have played a key role in the shaping of planetary nebulae, that binaries form aspherical shapes, has been around for the best part of 50 years. But the actual observational evidence has been pretty slow going, because these binaries are pretty difficult to find. And I mean, some of them may even merge. So when the star engulfs its partner, it may engulf it so badly that the core of both stars merges and it basically becomes like one big star. Whereas what we're looking at really is when it swallows it up, but not completely. So basically it just helps to strip away the outside of the star. So for the last 50 years, it's been very slow going, and people have been slowly finding one binary here, one binary there, mainly by looking for variations in the brightness of the star. So in a very similar way to how people detect exoplanets, if one star goes in front of the other, it blocks out the light of the other star, and it gets a little bit dimmer, because these stars are so close to each other and so far away that we can't resolve them into two separate stars. They just look like one star to us. So we have to rely on these kind of indirect techniques, and one of the best is if you have an eclipse. If one star goes in front of the other, it gets momentarily darker, and then when the star pops out of the other side, it goes back to being the normal brightness again. So one of the things that I do is I spend a lot of time looking at the stars in the middle of these planetary nebulae to check whether their brightness changes with time, and if it changes periodically, so if it's repeatable, if every day at the same time it changes from being bright to dark and then back to bright again, then I know that the binary is orbiting around itself once every day.
So you mentioned these common envelopes that exist around these binary stars. Can you sort of perhaps go into a bit more detail about how those are generated, where they come from in the first place?
Yeah, so it's kind of a weird idea, because what you have to get is that stars aren't the same all the way through from the core to the end. They're kind of like an onion, especially when they're getting towards the end of their life, where the center of the star is now more made of heavier materials, because it's initially, when the star is born, it's mainly hydrogen. And then in the core, it turns hydrogen to helium, and then helium to other heavier elements. So then you end up right at the end with this fairly inert ball in the middle made up of heavier elements, and then the fusion kind of goes on in layers outside. And that's part of what drives it to swell up to 500 times its normal size. So they have this kind of onion-like structure. And so what happens is, as it begins to swell up, the presence of the other star begins to change its shape. So normally stars are round, but when you get them very close together, they become more like of a teardrop shape. In a very similar way to the moon and the earth, as the moon goes around the earth, it kind of distorts the earth. So this same thing, this tidal force, happens in stars. So the star that's now swelling up, which we call the primary star, begins to get a sort of teardrop shape, where the point of the teardrop is going towards the other star. And then as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, there becomes a point where the parts on the outside of this star are no longer gravitationally connected to the core of itself. So the force of gravity from one star on the other become kind of balanced. So this material is almost free. It could escape from the star, but it can't escape from the entire system, because the collective gravity of the two stars is still too strong. So it ends up forming a sort of cloud around both stars. So that's what we call the common envelope. It's basically the very outer layers of the onion of the star that's beginning to swell up, that's beginning to die, that get stripped away and end up swallowing up both stars. And then the weird stuff that goes on inside that, we don't really understand. But what we know is that it basically acts as though the two stars carry on going around each other inside this cloud, but they experience quite a lot of friction because it's like they're now orbiting in treacle. And so that slows them down and it brings them closer together. So before this period, they could have orbital periods of hundreds of years. They could be very wide, but by the end of it, they come out and they're orbiting each other in periods of days. You know, these are two big stars, bigger than the Earth, which go around each other once every day, whereas the Earth goes around the Sun once every 365 days. So they're pretty extreme. So just as they're spinning around each other really fast inside this common envelope, just like if you go around the roundabout faster and faster, you kind of get thrown to the outside of your car, and your car might even begin to tip up on its two wheels. So the same thing happens here, but that energy that's trying to make things go out is transferred into the common envelope, into the treacle that they're spinning around in. So that means that this ball of gas begins to be thrown out, but not omnidirectionally. It doesn't go in every direction. It gets focused into the plane in which they're spinning, because it's, you know, if you go around a roundabout, you don't fly upwards, you fly outwards, you fly away from the center of the roundabout. So all of this material ends up focused in the plane, and it turns into sort of like a ring that surrounds the two stars. And then, if we form these beautiful planetary nebulae, what we think is this ring of material then prevents the new nebula from expanding into a nice sphere. It kind of sits around the waist like a belt and turns it into this hourglass-like shape. So then this torus of material, this ring, forms the waist of the hourglass.
So essentially we wouldn't get these really pretty sort of butterfly and hourglass shapes if we didn't have this binary at the very
Absolutely.
Start of the whole thing.
Absolutely. I have a colleague of mine that says that these beautiful bubbles betray a difficult cosmic marriage between these two binary stars. And I think that's a beautiful way of looking at it.
Well, I think that's a nice image to end on. So, Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.